Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. A World Health Organization resolution put forth to support breastfeeding faced a surprising foe this spring in Geneva. The United States launched a forceful opposition to the resolution, going so far as to threaten the sponsor country of Ecuador with loss of U.S. military and other aid. A New York Times report suggested that U.S. delegates were playing to the corporate interests of infant formula makers that have seen their market share shrink around the world. The resolution ultimately passed with the WHO recommendation that breastfeeding was the preferred nutrition for the first 6 months of the child's life. Esther Gillette is an international breastfeeding lactation consultant and president of the Central Ohio Breastfeeding Coalition. She joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann.
This is not the idea that breastfeeding is best, at least through the first 6 months, is not controversial, is it?
No, it's not. There are many scientific agencies, health organizations that support breastfeeding. The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends exclusive breastfeeding for this first 6 months and continuing to at least a year. And after that is mutually desired. And actually, the World Health Organization recommends breastfeeding up until age two. There are a host of health benefits for mothers and babies and also society as well.
Like, what are the benefits?
Okay, well, it protects the health of mothers and babies.
How so? How does it do that?
Well, okay, so first of all, with infants, it helps fight infection because mother's milk, human milk is made for human babies. So it's species specific. So each mother provides antibodies, her own antibodies to fight infections and allergies. So the babies receive that protection, whereas formula does not provide that. Reduces the risk of ear infections, respiratory infections, gastrointestinal infections. It actually reduces the risk of SIDS, infant mortality.
SIDS being I'm having a brain.
Sudden infant death syndrome.
Yeah, sorry.
It actually helps reduce the risk of chronic diseases such as diabetes and obesity. And obesity is a big thing, you know, here in the United States. So it provides a lot of protection for infants. And then mothers benefit from reduced risk of breast and ovarian cancer. And because the hormones that their bodies release when they breastfeed, it helps promote bonding. It makes them feel good. It helps to reduce the risk of postpartum depression as well.
Huh. Wow.
And
it's a cavalcade of reasons why. But the World Health Organization isn't as concerned about the United States per se as it is, you know, less developed countries around the world. And that's where this has been controversial. One interesting thing that came up was that women in poorer countries, if they're using formula, sometimes dilute it because they want to stretch it. It's expensive. And that can create problems because the water is unsafe.
Okay. Well, actually, I mean, that's also happening here in the United States.
Yes, of course.
With diluting the formula because formula is very expensive. Because the formula companies spend billions of dollars marketing their products and advertising. So then the consumer bears that cost. But the thing is, in these underdeveloped countries, that the water can be unsanitary. They're mixing it with the formula. The infant gets sick. I know it came up that, you know, mothers that are malnourished or in poverty, you know, they need the formula. Well, no, actually, mothers that are malnourished can actually breastfeed. Mm-hmm. They can still produce good quality milk for their infants. You know, breast milk it's safe. It's a safe food. It's always available. It doesn't require any preparation.
You know, it's not always available, though. Not everybody is able to do that, right?
Yes. I mean, formula does have a purpose, certainly. Formula should be available for those women that either choose not to breastfeed or maybe they have medical conditions that prevent them from breastfeeding. But mothers should always be given adequate information on breastfeeding during their pregnancy so they can make an informed decision.
And how do you judge you're getting adequate information? How do you know enough or you're getting the right kind of information?
Okay, that's a really good question. Information is best given from people that have gone through breastfeeding training. Getting information from formula companies does not always it undermines breastfeeding. So taking breastfeeding classes, there's a breastfeeding support group, La Leche League, that mothers can get information during their pregnancy and also get help afterwards. But mothers need to educate themselves before they have their babies. And if a mother doesn't succeed with breastfeeding, then she should not made to be felt guilty by not breastfeeding. So any amount of breast milk is certainly better than none.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about breastfeeding today. It's not particularly a controversial topic, all things being equal. There are the issues of public breastfeeding and that kind of a thing. But whether or not breast milk is best for baby is pretty accepted in the medical and science fields now. There's been plenty of studies done, and yet the United States launched an opposition to a resolution that in the World Health Organization that supports breastfeeding. So we thought we would raise the issue again and answer any questions. If you have a question or comment about breastfeeding, my guest is Esther Gillette. She's an international breastfeeding lactation consultant and president of the Central Ohio Breastfeeding Coalition. She's here to answer your questions. So 614-292-8513, or you could email us at allsides@wosu.org. When it does come to problems with breastfeeding, what are some of the common issues that maybe that people are confronted with? And if they don't have a lactation consultant right there with them, they think, well, I just can't do this. Can you talk about those?
Okay. Well, most of the common problems arise from mothers think that they don't have enough breast milk. And again, it involves being educated on how breastfeeding works, how to get started with breastfeeding, knowing where to get help. And that is just very, very critical. So the first 2 weeks are really the critical time of getting breastfeeding started. And mothers not knowing if the baby is getting enough. Mm-hmm. They don't see the milk like they do in a bottle. Mm-hmm. Their baby's crying. They might think it needs a bottle. So there's just a lot of information that mothers aren't getting. And there is help out there. Granted, there could be more help. I really think mothers would benefit from seeing a lactation consultant, getting a home visit should be mandatory in that first week.
But it's not.
It's not happening.
You know, and most women are in and out of the hospital if they're lucky, meaning there's been a healthy birth and everything went as planned within 24 hours nowadays.
Yes.
So there's not a chance to see a lactation consultant in hospital for most people.
The lactation consultants in the hospitals have to prioritize who they see. They try to get around to see every mother, mm-hmm. and a mother needs to advocate for herself if she's having a problem to let the nurses know. But there are lactation consultants in the hospitals to help. But it's when that mother goes home, she needs the support not just from the lactation consultant, but her family and friends. They need to be educated on breastfeeding as well, and her support person. Whoever that may be, father of the baby, the partner, it's a whole team of people working together to help support this mom. And only 60% of mothers find that they are they're not meeting their breastfeeding goals. 60% of mothers aren't reaching their breastfeeding goals.
Which, what does that mean? They're not producing enough milk?
Well, there's concerns over, certainly okay. If the baby's gaining enough weight, they're having trouble with breastfeeding. They're not sure if things are going right. But, there was a study that came out that 60% of mothers
don't feel confident about what they're doing.
Yeah, they don't reach their goals.
Sometimes new mothers are busy. Maybe they're not drinking enough fluids. That could be an issue, can it?
Well, actually, drinking enough fluids and
really
eating a good
difference.
Quality diet doesn't have an effect on the quantity and quality of milk.
Okay.
What makes milk is frequent and effective removal of breast milk.
Pumping
from the mother's breast.
If need be.
If a mother goes back to work or needs to be separated from her baby if the baby's in the hospital. Or if a mother can't even breastfeed, if she's unable to put the baby directly to breast, then second best would be pumping her milk and using that milk. And then following that, if she couldn't do it, actually human donor milk would be best. And then formula would be the last choice.
Why wouldn't a mother not be able to put the baby to breast? You mean if she's working or something like that and is it separated from the baby or
what? If she's separated from the baby or maybe she's having some difficulty latching the baby onto the breast. Maybe she has inverted nipples. Something could be going on, with the baby as well, anatomically. So mother or baby, there could be issues either way.
And does the breast, you said that they recommend up to age two. Ideally, most people can't do that, particularly women who work outside the home, that kind of a thing. But you've been doing this for about 30 years now, one way or another. And I'm wondering what kind of big trend lines you've seen. Are things getting better?
Things are actually getting better. And actually, I have some statistics I brought with me. Because the breastfeeding initiation rates have certainly increased. There has been great strides made in increasing breastfeeding. Just like I said, more work needs to be done. Breastfeeding in public laws in the workplace. But not all these people are aware of the laws. But for the 2020 breastfeeding rates, the target is 81.9%. for initiation ever breastfed. And the U.S. has already reached in 2016 81%. Ohio's at 77.7%. But by the time that child's 6 months old, the breastfeeding rates have already gone down to about 51.8% in the U.S. and 43.8% in Ohio. So we're having like about a 50% drop. And the target is 60.6%. And that's any breastfeeding. So exclusive rates are even lower when it comes to breastfeeding at 3 months, giving babies only breast milk. And that has to do with, with moms going back to work.
Not having a place to pump.
Right. Well, there is the Fair Labor Standards Act mandated that employers provide a place and time for mothers to pump, but still, mothers face barriers in the workplace, and not all employers are as accommodating. No one's out there to enforce it.
Right. Tiffany in Dayton, you're on the air. Hi, Tiffany.
Hello. Yeah, I'm actually breastfeeding at the moment.
Hey.
I was just, going through the channels, and I was like, I have to chime in on this. I'm 30, about to be 33 now, and I had my son, my first son, when I was 30, and I just knew that I had studied enough breastfeeding, I had watched enough videos, talked to enough professionals, and I ended up having a cesarean. And when I came, to myself, all I could do was think, like, I got to breastfeed, where's my baby, and they were keeping him in the NICU.
The neonatal intensive care unit, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Not allowing me to get to him. And I was like, what's this about? Like, I've told you with my birth plan, I'm one of the mothers that want to breastfeed right away. What's going on? And
they say?
They're like, oh, the medication you're on, you can't breastfeed. I'm like, what? Stop giving me the medication then. Like, if I have to choose between my pain and my comfort, I would rather be able to feed my child and just deal with my pain. I ended up actually recovering from cesarean on just Tylenol because they refused to stop, telling me that I couldn't breastfeed my own child because of the medication they were giving me. Huh. And I ended up, actually having a really big fight with a lot of the nurses in terms of trying to advocate for them stop. Like, they would feed him formula behind my back, and just all kinds of just craziness. And he ended up having a lot of issues with lactose because of it. I have issues with lactose. So them implementing the formula that had the actual lactose in it was really, it did him no good. I had a really hard time getting him to latch on. But he did breastfeed for 18 months. I'm so proud of that. But it took us about 2 weeks to adjust to get him to actually prefer the breast over the formula they were giving.
Well,
it was just really good.
Tiffany, that's interesting on a couple different levels. And I want to ask Esther Gillette, what is the protocol in hospitals? Is there one? Is there rules and regulations about this?
Well, that's a good question. And actually, there are guidelines that the hospitals should be doing regarding encouraging mothers skin to skin with their babies within that first hour of birth. And even, I'm not sure when you had your baby, but hospitals are working now to put mothers and babies together skin to skin even after cesarean section. So I'm really sorry that had happened to you. But, you know, skin to skin after delivery, even if a mother chooses not to breastfeed, just having that bonding time, the discharge bags of formula are not to be given to help encourage breastfeeding. But there's this baby-friendly hospital initiative. There's 10 steps. And some of the hospitals are working towards becoming baby-friendly. There's several hospitals in Ohio that have, but it involves training the hospital staff on breastfeeding. So there are some nurses right now that are going to have more information about breastfeeding than others. And actually, when it comes to the medications, most medications you can breastfeed with. So, you know, even on a lot of the pain medications that the mothers are given in the hospital, if a mother takes too much, it can make the baby kind of sleepy. But that should not deter her from breastfeeding.
Tiffany, thanks for that call. And Esther Gillette, thanks to you for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Okay, thanks.
Esther Gillette is an international breastfeeding lactation consultant and president of the Central Ohio Breastfeeding Coalition. We're talking about breastfeeding today because of the United States opposing a resolution in the World Health Organization to support breastfeeding as an optimal choice around the world. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Sunscreen protects our skin, but it's killing the coral reefs of the world. The state of Hawaii has responded with a new law that bans sunscreens that contain the chemicals scientists say endanger coral reefs. The ban goes into effect in 2021. Nika Laiba is director of healthy living science at the Environmental Working Group, which publishes an annual sunscreen guide detailing the ingredients of some 650 products. Nika Laiba joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
What are the most common ingredients that do the most damage to the coral reefs?
So the ban in Hawaii takes into account oxybenzone and octinoxate. And oxybenzone is a very, very commonly used active ingredient in non-mineral sunscreens. And it's known to harm coral health, but it also may affect human health as well, which is why we're concerned about it.
Well, that was my next question, is if these chemicals are bad for coral reefs, are they bad for us too?
Yeah, and in the case of oxybenzone and octinoxate, they definitely have been linked to effects on our hormone system. And those are some of the similar effects that we're seeing in coral reef So it's having endocrine disrupting effects on coral reefs and can cause coral bleaching and coral death. But these are some of the effects we're concerned about in humans as well. Obviously, they would have different ultimate effects, but any changes to our hormones could be potentially harmful.
Oxybenzone, that's what deflects the ultraviolet rays, right?
It's one of the ingredients that deflects or absorbs UV rays. There are about 17 ingredients allowed for use in the U.S. that are designated as active ingredients, which means that they absorb or deflect UV light.
So if these 17 ingredients are approved for use in the U.S., I mean, if they're approved for use, what have they approved them for? I mean, if they're possibly changing our hormones, they hurt coral, what's the criteria, I guess, that the U.S.
right.
is using?
And that's such a great question. And the criteria that the FDA, which is the agency that oversees sunscreens and other OTC drugs, the criteria is too lax, basically. But it just looks at how a product deals with, attenuates, they call it, UV light. So does it deflect adequately or does it absorb adequately? And even their definition of adequately does not rise to the level in other countries. So many of the products that are on store shelves in the U.S., although they meet the FDA criteria, they would not be able to be sold in Europe, for example, because they're not protective enough against some of the UV light we're exposed to.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about sunscreen. The state of Hawaii has enacted a new law. It goes into effect in 2021 that would ban several kinds of sunscreen that at use out there. That it would make it illegal to sell it and use it because it's killing the coral reefs. My guest is Nika Leiba. She is director of Healthy Living Science and Environmental Working Group at the Environmental Working Group. It publishes an annual sunscreen guide detailing the ingredients of some 650 products. If you have a question about sunscreen, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You look at 650 products. This is an ongoing thing. You've been doing it for several years now. Has anything changed? Are we getting better at what we're exposed to, or is it getting worse?
It's pretty stagnant. Yes, this is our 12th guide, so we've been looking at this for at least 12 years, and there has been some positive movement in the sunscreen industry. There are more mineral-based products on the market now, which means that products have the active ingredients, titanium dioxide and zinc oxide, and these are, as I said before, mineral-based products. They have a good toxicity profile, and they provide good broad-spectrum protection. But unfortunately, we're still seeing way too many products on the market with oxybenzone and other ingredients of concern.
And again, this is stuff that you can't get in Europe, and it includes things like Aveeno, Banana Boat, Coppertone, Neutrogena. These are very common products here.
Yeah, two-thirds of the non-mineral sunscreens in the U.S. contain oxybenzone. So again, it's a very, very common ingredient. And it's widely found in a lot of the big brands that you just mentioned. However, I do want to note that a lot of those brands also produce products that are mineral-based and are on our recommended list. So it's really important not just to look at the brand, but okay. to turn over the product and look at the actual ingredient list.
So tell us about the significance of mineral versus non-mineral. What's going on there?
So the mineral options, like I mentioned before, zinc oxide and titanium dioxide, mm-hmm. are true broad-spectrum protection, which means that they protect both from UVA and UVB rays. Zinc oxide is actually one of the best options that the FDA has approved. And again, on unbroken skin, in lotion form, the toxicity of these ingredients are pretty low. On the chemical side, you have oxybenzone, octinoxate, avobenzone, and some other hard-to-pronounce ingredients. Mm-hmm. And they tend to not be truly broad-spectrum on their own, so you tend to see companies using up to six of them together in order to get broad-spectrum protection. But unfortunately, a lot of the chemical options have been linked to health harms.
Why do they use the chemicals? What's the advantage?
So I think most people will know that the mineral options tend to leave a little bit of a white cast on the skin. So if you think of the quintessential surfer with the white streak down his nose, mm-hmm. that's zinc oxide. But in more modern sunscreens, they've been able to make the product more translucent. But a lot of people don't like that feel or that look. So they tend to opt for the chemical options.
Yeah, I do notice that on some I see that and others I don't. And now I understand why. Is this an issue that's gone before the FDA? I mean, has the FDA addressed it at all?
The FDA has not addressed it. EWG has met with the FDA several times and has sent many letters to them asking them to approve more ingredients, and they are looking into additional ingredients. As I mentioned, there's 17 ingredients approved for active ingredients in sunscreens in the U.S. versus 27 in Europe. So we would really like the FDA to approve more active ingredients and ones that have a much better toxicity profile so that companies have more options.
Okay. So the mineral options that you mentioned earlier, aren't harmful to the coral reefs?
No, not compared to oxybenzone and octinoxate. Obviously, more studies need to be done, but as of now, the risk is minimal.
It's hard to imagine that something like sunscreen is harming. I mean, we know the coral reefs are dying at an exponential rate now.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to imagine that something like a chemical in a sunscreen is causing the problems.
It is, and it's unfortunate because obviously a lot of people that wear sunscreens are going into oceans. But when you think of personal care in general, whether it's sunscreens or lotions, and you're aware that most of the chemicals in there have never been assessed for safety or not adequately assessed for safety, once you get that true understanding of the state of our personal care market and the state of the laws that regulate these products, you wouldn't be shocked at all. It's unfortunate, but a lot of the products we use have ingredients of concern, and not just concern for the environment, but concern for human health as well.
So what should people be looking for? What do you recommend?
So EWG, as you mentioned, has looked this year at more than 1,000 SPF products, but 650 beach and sports sunscreens, which are the ones you'd use for recreational activity. And we are able to recommend more than 200 that meet our strictest criteria for sun protection and for health. And so your listeners or the American public can go to the EWG website at ewg.org and find a sunscreen that is suitable for them. Again, not all of the mineral options will have the same whitening effect, so it may just mean trying a few options until you find one that's perfect for your skin.
Nancy in Lisbon, you're on the air. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
I have a question. I had done some reading and for my father, who was vitamin D deficient. And the articles that I've read from some of these universities were stating that have done research that the sunscreens that people are using today are a major concern for vitamin D deficiency because they're not absorbing the vitamin D from the sun and that they promote cancer more than skin cancer than prevent it. And I was wondering what she, the young lady was,
yeah.
What her thoughts are about that.
Nika Leiba?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, Nancy. And any sunscreen that is effective against protecting from the sun will decrease the amount of vitamin D that you absorb from the sun. So that is a concern. However, what medical experts have said is that you can get vitamin D through other means. You can get supplementation, and you can increase vitamin D through your diet. So there's other ways that you can increase vitamin D that may be helpful. So if vitamin D is a concern for you, I would recommend that you speak to a doctor about other ways that you could improve your vitamin D levels.
What about causing cancer?
In terms of vitamin D?
No. Well, Nancy, you said that...
Oh. The chemicals. It's just that's what caught me when I was listening to the program when she was talking about the coral reef. And in my family, my one son had a lot of surgery on his face, and it was starting to deform his face from sun or skin cancer, which we don't have any of that in our family.
Uh-huh.
And they're always constantly slathering on, because we have a farm, and they have a farm and
uh-huh.
constantly slathering on the sunscreen. And I finally told him, I go to a holistic doctor, and he said, don't use it. And I told him not to use it, and he gave him something else to use to help protect him.
Uh-huh.
But I told him he said, wear a brim on your hat or a brimmed hat, mm-hmm. and protect yourself a little bit more. But there is such a rise in skin cancer that we never seen before.
Right.
When we were kids, we were brown and running around. And,
right.
You know,
Yeah, I know, Nancy, I hear you. Nika?
Yeah, I think that's a perfect advice from the doctor that you went to. You definitely don't want to rely on sunscreens alone. Sunscreens should just be one tool in the toolbox. You should be wearing hats and sunglasses and avoiding the midday sun. But one of our concerns, Nancy, is that a lot of the products on the market, actually 2/3 of the products that we assessed, don't meet the safety requirements. So that means they're not adequately protecting from UVA rays. So yes, you may be slathering them on, and people may be using them as they think they should be using them. But if you're not being adequately protected from UVA rays, your risk of cancer could actually be going up, because UVA rays have been linked to not only skin damage and skin deformation, but also skin cancer. So it's really, really important that you use a sunscreen that adequately protects and that doesn't contain additional harmful ingredients, which is where the EWG recommended list comes in. But I also really love the advice that you were given about using a hat, mm-hmm. And all of those other protective measures.
What about rash guard? I was just looking at a rash guard. They call them rash guard clothing, UV protected clothing.
Anything that covers the body and protects the body from the rays of the sun would be helpful. The one thing about rash guard or other products that impregnate the fabric with sunscreens is I would call the manufacturer and find out what chemicals they're using. Huh. Because in actuality, any tightly woven shirt or any tightly woven garment will offer sun protection. You don't actually need the chemicals to be impregnated in them. So if your listeners can know if it's protecting by holding up the fabric to the sun. If you can see a lot of sunlight filtering through, that means you need something with a tighter weave. But any tightly woven garment will offer adequate sun protection and will help.
I guess those kinds of garments, whether they're treated or not, that's a good question, and I want to check on that. But they're airier. You know, they're not as, you know, that's a selling point with them.
Right. And in that case, you just want to check what chemicals, because if you are using something that's impregnated with harmful chemicals that's going to wash off into the ocean and damage the reefs anyway or get into your system, then it defeats the purpose of finding a better sunscreen.
Okay. Well, Nika Leiba, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about this. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Anne.
Nika Leiba is Director of Healthy Living Science, Healthy Living Science at the Environmental Working Group. We'll have a link to their list and their review of sunscreens, what works, what doesn't, what's healthy, what isn't, and what's hurting the coral reefs and what won't on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. When you Google a medical symptom, you may be getting more than you are bargaining for in return. Catherine Roberts covers food and health issues for Consumer Reports. This spring, she wrote about why the doctor's office might be a safer choice than the internet. Catherine Roberts joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann.
Consumer Reports survey found that a majority of Americans Google their medical symptoms now. Are there common themes in what they're looking for?
Well, we didn't look specifically at what people were looking for, but we do know that folks Google their medical symptoms. It's almost inevitable, really. You know, if your kid has a cough, you're going to want to look it up. You might call the doctor, but you might try an internet search first.
Right. I had some symptoms. I tried an internet search and it said I was having a heart attack and it turned out to be a pinched nerve in my neck. That's a really good example, right, of how you could be misled.
Absolutely. You know, there's a lot of good information out there on the internet, but there's also a lot of bad information out there on the internet. You know, there's one study that I looked at that showed, you know, search engine results for medical symptoms, you know, varied in accuracy. The more common a illness was, the more likely your search results were to give you an accurate diagnosis. The less common, you know, the illness is, the less likely the search engine is to pull it up. You're kind of rolling the dice as far as the accuracy of what you're going to get from the internet.
And when you do these searches, you're sharing information about yourself, right?
Yes. The thing is, you know, when you're sitting there with Google, it feels like it's just you and Google. But actually, there's a lot of other people, companies, entities that might be watching what you're doing.
And how does that manifest then?
Well, a couple of different ways. So one thing is, you know, a privacy expert I spoke with compared this to looking into a double-sided mirror. You know, you can see your own activity and only that, but there's a lot of other folks behind the mirror that can be watching what you're doing. So there's a lot of what we call third-party trackers that can see when you visit a web page. Some of them are familiar, Twitter, Facebook. They might know that you're on a page, for example, because of, you know, the little Facebook like button that's on the page. So even if you don't click the like button, Facebook still knows that you're on the page.
Ah.
And they can collect, they can, you know, that they can use that information about you. And there's other companies that do this, just maybe not in such an obvious way. They can know you're on a page even if you don't really know that they're there.
And who's sponsoring the page is an issue as well.
Sponsoring in what way?
Who's running the site that you're looking at? It could be a special interest.
Right, right. I mean, you know, it's one thing about this whole topic is it can just get really murky to understand who owns what you're looking at, who's watching what you're looking at. It's just very hard to understand really what's going on behind the scenes.
What's your recommendation? I mean, in some senses, the internet is helpful. I mean, people can get information from the internet. Maybe they don't have easy access to a physician. What do you recommend if people do want to use the internet to search for medical issues?
Right, right. I mean, it's important to, as you say, recognize that no one's saying like never Google any medical issues online at all. Part of it is sort of weighing the risk. You know, if you are Googling something like a cough and a runny nose, there's not a lot of information that a third party, there's, you know, everyone gets coughs and colds. So there's not a lot that they can pin to you specifically for that. But the more sensitive type of searches you might want to be careful with. Probably the most basic recommendation is to start with using a private browsing mode, so like Google Incognito. I actually checked in with one of my colleagues here at Consumer Reports this morning about that. He just wrote a story on private browsing mode for our website, cr.org, and he said, you know, it's kind of the least you can do type of measure. So Google Incognito, private browsing, erases your search history from the browser once you're finished browsing. And that helps you avoid some types of embarrassing things that can happen, like getting served an ad later that someone else might see about what you've searched. You know, maybe you Googled something about a sexually transmitted infection, and then someone else sees an ad related to that. Google Incognito, private browsing mode, can help with that kind of thing. So that's sort of the first step. Beyond that, you can download tools, install tools into your browser that block third-party trackers. These can be really helpful. Ad blockers are a version of this, but you can get third-party tracker blockers that do more than just ad blocking. I personally use one called Privacy Badger. Consumer Reports has partnered with another. It's called Disconnect. There's plenty of these out there, and you can visit our website actually to see a rundown of all the different options. And then the third, the most like intense option, there's a web browser called Tor, T-O-R. It's an encrypted browser that you can download. And it's the privacy experts I've spoke with have said, you know, this is sort of as close as you can get to being totally anonymous online. It's not perfectly anonymous because that's pretty much impossible, but it's as close as you can get. You might need, you know, it might take a little bit of tech savvy to figure it out. Not a ton. It's not hugely complicated, but that's kind of the most private that you can get online.
There are people turning to online medical services such as therapists, and I was surprised at that. This is where you're just doing a chat with somebody. You don't know who they are or what's going on there.
Well, you know, I haven't looked into those types of services so much. You know, we haven't looked at those so intensely, but, you know, it's always good to be cautious whenever you're sharing any medical information over the internet. You really want to be sure that you know who you're talking to and who you're sharing with.
Are people very good at knowing what the sources of the information are?
You know, it's hard to say how much people really understand about vetting sources. I mean, it's one thing as far as like looking up accurate and safe medical information is there are some established sites that you can use. So I always recommend people look, if they're looking for stuff about medical conditions, the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, the great website with tons of very, you know, accurate information that you really can trust. It's hard to vet, you know, once you get into other types of sites. It's really hard to know what's right.
and accurate, right?
Right, exactly. It's hard to know. CDC, the National Institutes of Health, is another one. They have a ton of information on their many websites that you can trust because it's definitely backed up by science.
Do we know if, say, Ask Bing or Google or whatever is better than another when it comes to search engines?
You know, the study I mentioned earlier, this researcher that was looking at search engines and how accurate the medical information was that they served up, he said to me, you know, you couldn't really say that one search engine was better at giving accurate results in this field than others. So I wouldn't rely on one over another as far as giving you accurate medical information.
With the rules changing about what we can see on the internet and giving engines, you know, or service providers, internet service providers, power to control what we see, is Consumer Reports. Are you guys concerned at all about that? That we might have to pay to get better and more information?
Well, Consumer Reports, we're definitely concerned about all aspects of digital privacy. It's a big issue for us where we have a lot of advocacy around ensuring privacy and safety online. It's definitely a big issue for us.
Mm-hmm. What do you recommend? I mean, for people who don't have access, you know, you're talking about how to keep yourself safe. What else? I mean, besides keeping your privacy intact, what other kinds of issues are there?
As far as your medical information, I mean, you know, protecting your browsing is one thing. Another thing that privacy experts tell me, especially as far as your health information, is not sharing stuff on social media. So it's so easy to make a post about how annoying it was at your doctor's office and how you had to wait at the pharmacy or whatever. But if you say the name of your doctor and say the name of your pharmacy, that's information that, those are puzzle pieces that someone nefarious could use against you and use to, pretend to be you in order to get medical care. Medical identity theft is a really devastating thing that does happen to people. And the more pieces you put out there for people to see and collect about you, the more vulnerable you make yourself.
What's medical identity theft?
It encompasses a few things, but essentially it's when someone uses your identity, your personal information to get medical care. So an example would be using your social security number or your name or your stolen driver's license and going to a doctor and getting care that then gets billed to you and can mess up your medical record. It can just create a whole host of huge problems. And that's one reason you want to do everything that you can to keep all your medical information private.
Including your doctors, where you go, your pharmacy, and that kind of a thing, right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
And people who are not the consumer privacy experts, you said, offer more advice for keeping your information safe, and you have a 10-minute digital privacy tune-up?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, we really recommend...
Looks like we've lost Catherine. Okay. Catherine, are you there? Nope. We've lost Catherine Roberts. She covers health and food for Consumer Reports. We've been talking about the cautionary article in Consumer Reports recently that talks about whether you should Google your medical symptoms and the kind of things you're oversharing, perhaps. Like I said, you can go to their 10-minute digital privacy tune-up. If you go to the Consumer Reports website, check that out. I want to say thanks to the AllSides staff, assistant producer Kyle McKinnon, senior producer Mary Lee Williams, AllSides interns Martin Coleman, Alexander Havolchik, Scott Good, and Ray Brewster, with video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. Alan DeCenzo is a composer of our theme music. WSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla, Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook and follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me on Twitter too at Ann Fisher WOSU. Thanks for listening today. This has been Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.